Hello there. Thank you so much for tuning in if you're watching live. And again, thank you so much for watching back or listening back on the podcast, rather. I hope you're having a great week and you're keeping well. I know for me, it's been feeling quite strange and different for going through all the normality of what's going on. But I'm so, so excited to have my guest today, who's someone who I think I've worked it down that it's been a year and a week since I first met in Malta, of all places. One thing I think you're absolutely going to love from me chatting through to her is how she's managed to define her own career and do things off her own back to start off with, as well as what she's been up to during lockdown, which is fascinating. So today I'm so, so happy to be joined by Julia Zilberquist. Julia, how are you doing?
Hi, how are you? It's great to be here, David.
Thank you so, so much for being on. One thing I'm always really curious when I start these chats is asking you to define yourself, which one saves me the job of having to introduce you, but also I always think it's fascinating to hear how people define themselves. So what is it that you do in the world?
Well, as you know, I'm a classical pianist. We met in Malta last year, right, at the Malta International Festival. I've been playing piano since the age of four, so that's pretty much what I do. But I feel like when you do something for so long, you always look for other outlets because, you know, our repertoire is only, you know, as big as it is. So some time ago, I started arranging different things for piano and orchestra, and expanding the piano repertoire, even though it's huge and very rich and humongous. So what I've done was I created the pieces out of existing versions. For example, Shostakovich wrote a concertino for two pianos for his son. And it's a beautiful, very short piece, which ended up being, after my arrangement, a concerto, a one-woman concerto for piano and orchestra with a cadenza. And therefore we got a third Shostakovich concerto in a way. And we'll talk about it later. I've done the same things with some Vivaldis and Bach, and basically try to create more interesting and new repertoire for us. On the other hand, as you know, I kind of manage myself, so I don't have a manager, so I have that hat as well, which is very challenging, you know, especially in the times of this, but always challenging. It's always hard to promote yourself, to, you know, sort of sell yourself, if you will. I'm also, you know, I have a family. I have a husband and two kids, as you know, so I have a mom hat. And as we just also talked about before we started, you could probably see the painting behind me. One of my hobbies is I collect art, a sort of a particular stream of art and painters. And it's a bit of my heritage. It's a bit of sort of a cultural heritage going back to Eastern Europe and Europe in general, you know, before the World War II. So that's my hobby. So I'm trying to sort of lead a very, the many, many lives in one, as a lot of us do, as I'm sure you do, as I know you do. But of course, first and foremost, I'm a musician.
Fantastic. And also just give you some context as well for your watching and listening, that you're also currently based in New York as well. So obviously you've been hit quite hard by lockdown and coronavirus there. So there've been lots of challenges for what you've been up to. And I think it's fascinating as well that you've been your own agent for such a long time, as they've been facing, or agents have been facing, such a difficult period. And we will get onto that shortly, I'm sure. So what is it you've been up to during lockdown? Partly to keep yourself sane, but what have you been doing musically as well?
So next week, there will be exactly 2 months that we're confined at our apartment. I have to say, I'm hoping New York is going to get better, because I know the statistics is very, very, it's been very, very concerning. But we're very fortunate, you know, we have a large apartment and everybody has their own room. I have my piano room here. It's my living room, and I have my beautiful Steinway B, a very, very nice piano from 1930. But I have to tell you that prior to an official quarantine, I was very fortunate to do a sold-out concert at Merkin Hall at Kauffman Center here in New York City with a Bacchanalia Chamber Orchestra, and it was dedicated to Bach. It was Bach's birthday, so I was doing Bach D Minor Concerto with an orchestra that was created by a very famous Russian violinist, Nina Belina, who recently, I would say she died a couple of years ago, but she was a legend. She was a legend of Russian violin school. She was a legend here. So her son is a director and violinist of the orchestra. It was a very nice concert to see everyone, and we had a sold-out house. However, we were already hit by COVID because the original conductor, a wonderful Michael Gottman, who is a violinist, a conductor, and a director of beautiful Pietrasanta Festival in Italy, he couldn't come from Milan. So 3 days before the concert, we had to find another conductor, who we did find. And it was sort of a bit of a closure for me because literally it was the last weekend before we closed. So then my confinement started, sort of being on quarantine. And, you know, honestly, I decided that I needed to take a little break from everyday practice because it was emotionally very hard. I knew that my summer festivals were going to get canceled or postponed. We'll talk about it. Luckily, they got postponed, not canceled. But what I was very fortunate and able to do, and something I'm very, very proud of, that finally I was able to sort of go through my digital history and create a YouTube channel, which I'm sure you'll be able to post the link, and I would love for our audience to check it out and subscribe. So finally, I was able to find some old videos, some audios, and some things that my labels, both Nexus and Warners, were posting on the YouTube. So I was able to create something whole for myself. And last week, I'm sort of preparing for this podcast, I was finally able to go for my website, which I also never had a chance to update. So I started updating it. So in a way, this pandemic, this quarantine, really helped me develop some other, you know, some other direction, if you will, of my career. Yes. And, you know, I found some fascinating facts. You know, you never listen to your own recording. You never go to your own YouTube links. So I, for example, had no idea, you know, how we leave a digital print. We talk about it, but we don't know. I'll give you a very simple example. When I was doing my arrangements and recording, one of them was to take two Vivaldi concerto grossi's. One was for two violins, one was for two violins and cellos, that later Bach has transcribed for organ. So what I did was I kind of combined the two and I created two new concerti grossi for piano and chamber orchestra. The orchestra part was really originally Vivaldi's part, and piano part was sort of a mixture of Bach and Vivaldi. And I have performed it many, many times. In fact, prior to meeting you in Malta in 2019, I was premiering it there in 2018, and I have a YouTube video of that. So when I recorded it with a wonderful, unfortunately deceased now, conductor Saulius Sandeskis and orchestra, Moscow Virtuosi Orchestra, we recorded two of these concerto and seven Bach keyboard concertos, right? So each has three movements. Say we have 27 tracks. So as I was transferring them to my YouTube channel, so that one of the tracks, a third movement of Bach's famous D minor concerto, was published on Nexus Japan, just this one track. And it attracted, I don't know, more than 6,000 viewers, just this one track. It's not even something that I would necessarily single out of those 27 movements, right? But I just found it fascinating, and I just realized it last week because I thought, why is one of the tracks is all in Japanese? Is it really me? Is it my track? So it just shows you how our, you know, things we do, usually we do, it's a live performance or it's a, you know, it's a recording or a show, but how the digital life now takes such an interesting shapes and forms. And especially now with pandemic, you know, we're talking to you, there's so many interesting concerts going on and theater productions, and I almost feel like there's too much going on now.
Yes, it's been fascinating to see what's actually happened, sort of people's reaction as well. Anne Majette was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and she had a Twitter thread recently she was involved in, where it was people talking about fatigue, about having too much audience fatigue, and there was too much going on and too much to take in, and people starting to switch off and not be as interested as they were, which I think is certainly a challenge going forward for all of us to face. So you touched on Malta and the International Music Festival there, which I think is a great place to start, because it's where we met, and it was genuinely 1 week and 1 year, 1 year and 1 week even, to the day. So it was on my birthday, which was April 30th, I flew out to Malta, and then it was just after then, I think 4 or 5 days into the festival, was your performance there, and that's when we first met, I think in the back of a car on the way back from the concert hall to dinner, if I remember rightly.
That's That's exactly right. And we started talking and you told me you live in Oxfordshire. And to your surprise, I knew all about it. And, you know, I'm a great fan of Great Britain and I knew that particular place and I was hoping to visit one day. So that's, I think, where we started.
Yes, I'm always amazed just partly how small the music world, but also how people tend to gel quite quickly within it as well, which is, I always think, fascinating. So one thing going forward, I think a lot of people are facing is how to have a career post-coronavirus. And I think the way that music agents have been struggling recently, is particularly during this crisis, is something that could be of use to or of interest to people listening. And you've been your own agent for such a long time. What was the reason that you decided to be your own agent, going back to when you first had the idea?
When I graduated from Juilliard School and I studied with a wonderful, wonderful Russian pianist, Bela Davidovich, who lives in New York, and she became a great friend. And in fact, her son, a wonderful violinist and a conductor, Dmitry Sitkovetsky, was my partner in Malta. He was conducting and performing as well our first concert, not the one when we met. And after Juilliard, you know, it was just basically a very usual route. I went to my big international competition. It was in Vienna. I got the first prize and I thought, you know, I got a lot of nice concerts out of that. I would think something that really, really will stay with me for the rest of my life was performing Beethoven 4th open air in Vienna with Sir Egudi Minuhin conducting. That's something you remember forever. He was really amazing. He was listening to the solos. He was quite old then, but he was very much together, and it was really an amazing experience. So I thought, you know, it's just going to go on from there. I will have more concerts. I will have comeback invitations, and it will be sort of on the roll, an automatic kind of automatic renewal, if you will. And that did not happen. Because, I mean, I realized there was a lot of pianists and, you know, even when you perform somewhere and you get a great press and a full house, it is not guaranteed that your agent or whoever is taking care of you will be pursuing it and doing something. So I went for a couple of agents, smaller agencies, where I thought they would advocate for me, and they never did. And as you probably know, or your audience, or they don't know, you know, there's a lot of people who take advantage of young artists financially. You know, you have to pay a retainer. They don't really do anything, or they don't do any concerts, or maybe they do one concert in 3 years. So at some point, after a third or fourth try, I just decided that it's not worth it and I'm going to try to go another route. I do have to say that I come from the family of musicians. My grandmother was a very, very, very famous piano teacher in Moscow, and she herself studied with the famous Professor Chagadaeva, who was a student of Scriabin many years ago in Odessa Conservatory. And my father, Dr. Mark Zilberquist, is a musicologist and a pianist. And right now he is running the biggest music publishing house in Russia. It's called Muzika. And he always music. And he always wrote about a lot of artists, a lot of musicians. And in fact, even when we were living in Russia, he was publishing interviews and articles about string players and pianists here in the States. So, of course, I knew a lot of musicians, which helped in a way, but in a way did not help, because, you know, if you sit with somebody at the table and have a social conversation, they may not necessarily think of you as a next soloist that they'll invite to perform with. So it was kind of, it went both ways. I did know a lot of musicians, but it was, in fact, harder for me to approach them than if I did not know them. So it happens. But gradually and eventually, you know, some connections started to form with conductors, with some orchestras, with some solo venues. And I have to say that I do not perform 300 concerts a year, even before pandemic. nor do I think one should do that. Because I feel, and I remember that was our car conversation, I don't think as human beings, as humans, we can't produce great and inspiring results 300 days a year. We can't. We have to prepare it for it mentally. We have to be sort of together with our audience on stage. Of course, there's such a situation when you do a tour. You do 10 concerts or even 15 concerts in a row, but that's different because you're touring with a certain orchestra or by yourself. But generally, I feel that it has to be a reflection. There has to be some thoughts and emotional involvement there at the performance. So that's why, you know, I don't perform as much as my other colleagues. Plus, as I told you, I have a family. I have two children. Now they're grown, but then they were younger. I wanted to be present. I wanted to make sure that I am there for the important events of their lives. So that was a choice. So I would say right now I perform more because they're grown up. But I don't know myself yet what's going to happen after that. That's a big reset for all of us.
Definitely. And it's been interesting talking to musicians in general. I know quite a few who've now had to stand still because of this crisis. And although it's obviously impacted people so negatively in lots of ways, they're saying that they're actually quite thankful for being able to sort of catch their breath in a way, and that the pace of being a musician in our current working climate has been exhausting, and you can't take time off, or you feel that if you say no to a gig or a concert, they won't ask you next time, and all these various bits. But I think it's great to hear you talk about as well the fact that knowing musicians and having networks is almost a double-edged sword, because I think that when you don't have these networks, you always think that it's impossible to get in, and once you do have them, it'll be perfect. But in essence, it's sort of a mixture of the two that in reality work for people, which is fascinating.
Indeed. And it's, you know, it's a mixture of luck and being at the right time, at the right place, as any profession. But I can tell you that I was really looking forward, as all of my colleagues, for their own reasons, to this summer, because I had some very, very good festivals. For example, I was going to premiere Shostakovich Concertina, which I talked about earlier, and which actually I performed when we met at the Malta Festival. I was invited to a very prestigious Shostakovich Festival near Dresden. It's the main Shostakovich event, really. And they were very nice. They did not cancel until the very, very last moment. And then they were very gracious in inviting me to come back next summer, which I'm really looking forward to. And the same, I was going to go to Switzerland, to Sion. There's a wonderful festival there directed by two wonderful violinists, Pavel Vernikov and Svetlana Makarova. And in August, we were going to premiere a very interesting piece. It's a trio for piano, two violins, and orchestra by a Georgian-Israeli composer, Joseph Bardanishvili. And it's dedicated to the memory of recently deceased another great, greatest Georgian composer, Gia Kancheli, who was the guest at Malta in 2018. That's the last time I saw him, and he's a friend of the family. So we were so much looking to doing a world premiere. So for now, it's postponed to 2021, and we're very much looking forward to that. And we're hoping that we'll be able to perform it sometime before. But in my opinion, as of now, I don't think the fall of 2020 will bring us many events. I'm hoping that by January of 2021, it will be sort of easier, and maybe we'll ease into that. And another reason I'm very upset, you know, there's plenty of reasons we're all upset about it, but you know, 2020 was a big year for Beethoven, as you know. In December, we're celebrating 250th anniversary since his, you know, birth, and it's a big, big event. And I had big plans for that season, sort of 2021, because among my arrangements, there's also a part where I play rare pieces, rare concertos. And some years ago, I found, you won't believe it, a virtually unknown Beethoven concerto, which he wrote when he was 14 years old, and later his student William Hess orchestrated it. Even though Beethoven, he put in a clavier part, he put all the instrumentation, so it wasn't really anything against his will. It's a wonderful three-movement classical concerto. I would say sort of a late Mozart, early Beethoven style, and we call it Concerto Number Zero. And in fact, you know, if everything goes as planned, we're going to do it in Malta in 2021. And I had a lot of other engagements with that have not yet been rescheduled, so I can't even talk about it. But it's one of my personal professional hits that we took was not being able to, even though, you know, I performed it in Moscow with Yuri Bashmet. I performed it in Warsaw at the Easter Beethoven Festival with Mikhail Yurovsky a couple of years ago. So I have played it a lot, but I felt that it was going to be more special. And it brings us to a whole new approach to Beethoven, because we always say Mozart was a child prodigy, and we talk about Beethoven in his late opuses, in his sort of middle of the life opuses, but he was in fact as genius, as sort of a wunderkind as Mozart, of course.
It's incredible. And you say, like, trying to rediscover these works that are not regularly played, it must be so rewarding when you do finally get the opportunities to do them. But again, it's a relatively sad moment that you're not able to do it in the way you had planned. I remember from seeing you in Malta and the pieces and repertoire you were doing there, and also your general career, is you seem to have quite a passion for either doing undiscovered works or little known works, and also your own arrangements of various things. What drives you to have this more creative approach to choosing your repertoire?
I would say it's very similar to deciding not to have an agent, because our world is so populated with musicians, with classical pianists, and basically everybody's doing the same, I would say 5 to 10 concertos, as you know, Tchaikovsky 1 and Rachmaninoff 2 and 3.
You should
really
try being a cellist. There's only like 3 for us that really actually sell tickets.
I decided I wasn't going to do that. There was another reason, I have to say, be honest. You know, as a nature goes, I have very small hands. It doesn't really bother me, but there's some things that I just, you know, it's very hard for me to stretch. And plus, I feel that there's so many wonderful, wonderful pianists who are doing those concertos. So I decided that I'm going to step outside of the box here and be a little bit more original. So in my list, as I already mentioned, so there's 2 Vivaldi Bachs that I made an arrangement of. There's Shostakovich that I made an arrangement of. There's Beethoven early concerto. There's a wonderful, wonderful one-movement concerto by César Franck. It's called Le Jeans, which was inspired by the poem of Victor Hugo about those magical creatures that, you know, come out of the vase. And in fact, you know, the poem is written visually, it looks like a genie coming out of the vase. And I remember there was a wonderful, wonderful recording of Richter and Kondrushin, but it's a very rarely performed piece because, you know, not only that it's a one movement concerto, it ends in pianissimo, in double piano. So it's very hard to program. But I played it recently in Moscow with a state orchestra and wonderful Russian-British conductor Mario Stravinsky. And I played it in New York at Carnegie Hall with American Symphony and wonderful, wonderful conductor and educator Leon Botstein. So that was a wonderful project. And another project that I can't not tell you about is a new piano concerto that was written in 1997. By Sergei Slonimsky, a wonderful Russian composer who died unfortunately last year, and who many Americans know as a nephew of famous Nicholas Slonimsky, you know, who wrote musical vocabulary. He's a very, very famous American musicologist who lived in LA, in Los Angeles. So many years ago, I played a beautiful piece by Sergei Slonimsky. It was called Intermezzo in the Memory of Brahms. I really liked it. I programmed it with my Brahms intermezzos. And I met the composer and I said, why don't you write a piano concerto for me? And I remember we were about to celebrate the 50th anniversary of State of Israel. And I said, it would be great to have maybe some Jewish themes. And he said, no, I don't write piano concertos. The genre is dead. I don't want to write it. I have so many symphonies and operas and, you know, so many works. And I talked to him and I tried to convince him. So to make a long story short, he wrote a concerto, which is called The Jewish Rhapsody for Piano and Orchestra, which was, you know, commissioned by me, and he dedicated it to me, and I've recorded it on Harmonia Mundi, and I've played it many, many times. I've played it, you know, in Russia and in Europe and here in USA. And let me tell you, since then, he even wrote a second piano concerto. So in a way, I feel responsible for 2 new piano concertos of 21st century, because we don't have that many. You would be surprised, you know, 20th century and 21st. I would say Well, of course, there's Schnittke, and there's my very good friend and colleague, wonderful composer Lera Overbach, and the wonderful Gia Cancelli. But generally, I would say the genre of piano concerto in the late 20th and early 21st century has not been as popular as, I would say, violin concerto, cello concertos. I don't know, maybe I don't know many of them, but I was very happy that I was instrumental in bringing, in fact, two more concertos as it happened.
Definitely, and it's also having an element of creativity in your what you're performing as well, the fact that you have a connection to it, but also if you say arranged it, it's an extra element of you being creative with your music. So one thing I'm also really curious to talk to you about is your decision to do new things online, and experiment with partly revisiting your previous catalogue and also experiment with YouTube and things. So is that partly again from this experience of being your own agent and having to find your own way that you're now trying to do new things online?
It's a great question. You know, sometimes things just, I suppose, come together, because if it were not for the pandemic, I would be preparing my new programs. I would be very busy. And I always thought, oh, I should do something on YouTube. I had one or two random videos that were posted by me or by, you know, the labels, but I was never able to really put them together. And now I hear that, especially at the beginning of pandemic, when people were feeling very down and very depressed, they said that the classical music really helps them and elevates their spirit. So I started doing that. Then I started sort of emailing and calling my friends and saying, hey, I have this new YouTube channel that, you know, you should check it out and subscribe. And it's, you know, it's, again, it's very hard to promote yourself, but I really wanted to have real people subscribing to my channel, people who will be listening. And last year I was doing Mozart Concerto number 23, you know, K-488, was a beautiful second movement. And actually it was my father who came up with this idea after I posted it. He said, you know, the second movement is so beautiful and it deserves to be its own post or link, if you will. And interestingly enough, I did post it separately just because I felt it was such a beautiful, beautiful music and so self-sufficient that it, and it has the most hits, it has the most views out of everything I've posted so far. So I guess people really need that sort of feeling of, I don't know, serenity or even sadness or reflection. So, and in my opinion, with the pandemic, with the fact that we don't know what's going on, we're going to do more and more things virtually. That's it. We can't go around it. I know big orchestras, I think Berlin Philharmonic was doing this big concert in May where they were on stage and social distancing. I don't know how it was acoustically for them, but it was fine on YouTube. And I feel like things, at least at the beginning, will change somewhat. I do feel sad because I love being with the audience, because when you perform at some very rare and lucky performances, you feel that connection. You know, you feel this reverberation of chemistry or whatever you want to call it. And it's very hard to get it with in studio or virtually. On the other hand, I know there's a lot of people who are doing sort of practicing online almost. I'm not a big fan of that because I feel that my practice is my own sort of kitchen. It's my own way how I approach things, and it may not be necessarily useful or interesting to many people. But, you know, again, there's two different thoughts of school there. I'm a perfectionist, so if I post something, it's only something, you know, that I've done 100% of, and I certainly don't want people to see something that's half cooked, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I was sort of very careful about when I actually practiced in practice rooms, partly because I didn't want anyone else to walk past and hear me practicing, then realise that I was surrounded by other musicians who would 100% not be listening because they don't care, because they hear music at every different bombarded level at them. Right. But I think you're right in saying it's really interesting to see what people are doing at the moment online, and also partly to see what works for them. And it's not just what works for the audience, but works for them artistically. And it's great that some people are showing practice rooms and what they're doing in their process, but equally, if that's not what you want to do, there's no reason or forcing nature for you to do that, which is great, as well as you want to really curate and do something and put something out that's more polished, which is fantastic.
Correct.
And what other response have you had from your online content, as well as obviously that piece where the serenity was really resonating?
It's been a very good response. You know, I hope our listeners will check out the YouTube. I'm still learning. For example, I'm still trying to enable comments, because people comment to me personally and they write very nice things. I haven't mastered the YouTube. I'm sure has been really, you know, heavily used during that pandemic. So I haven't mastered the art of how to include the comments below my video. For some reason, they were disabled. So it's still very challenging to me. But I feel that it's a way to, you know, have a more exposure, to have more people know about you and about the pieces you play. Now, unfortunately, and I'm sure it's true for almost everyone, not everything I've played, and especially rare pieces, are online video or audio. You know, I haven't recorded all of them. So that's somewhere where I feel very sad that, you know, I did not record my every performance, and maybe I would find something useful now. In fact, I was even going for my old recording sessions and thinking if I could find something that I didn't want to use before. You know, there's also a time element. I can tell you that every performer does not like to listen to their recordings. I can guarantee you that. But, you know, as time passes, especially if it's after the concert, because you feel that it went one way and the recording may show you that it went another way, not necessarily good or bad, but just different way, you know, how sometimes it translates into video or audio. So I found with myself that some of my old recordings, I find now that I can use them, that I like them more, sort of looking back, than I did right after they were recorded, because again, you have this idea in your head of how you think it should be. So it's a process, or something that I used to like that I don't like anymore. So it's kind of it's a process of elimination, of course. And I am hoping to put more things on YouTube eventually, but for now I feel like there's about 90-95% of what I've done is there, so I feel very satisfied. And it's probably time to sort of go back and learn new repertoire or repeat something else. It is a bit difficult because when you have no deadlines or or you don't know, for example, I have some fall events in Europe and in Russia and in some Asian countries. I don't think they will happen. They have not been canceled officially. But, you know, knowing also the fact that I'm overseas, I have to fly over the ocean. Honestly, I don't even know when I'll be psychologically ready to fly, when I will feel it's safe to fly for 9 hours, you know?
Totally. And I think as well, one thing that's also going to be a factor is when audiences feel safe to go and sit very close to the complete strangers as well, which I know that there's experiments or people trying to understand how social distancing for audiences could work in a setting, which is obviously going to affect ticket sales and revenue and various bits. So it's going to be fascinating. I think as well, potentially, we're going to see lots of musicians do lots more in their local areas, and potentially that the whole international side of things, which can be the more exhausting side of being a soloist, may not necessarily be the same going forwards, which could be interesting and different. I'm not entirely sure if it's better or worse, but it's going to be a unique thing for all of us going forwards. And I imagine as well for you, that must be quite a thing, because you seem quite the international traveller as well, going in sort of your history and where you've been all over the world, etc.
Yes, I travel a lot, of course, for business, for performance. And I also travel a lot because, you know, my family, my parents now live in Moscow. I have a lot of friends there, and I travel with my kids. We go to Europe because I would love for them to be exposed to European culture. In fact, every summer we take them to a different country. So they've seen, I would say, most European countries, maybe not so much sort of South America and Asia yet. But I have to tell you, with this post-pandemic, which you just mentioned, how we're going to get out of this crisis. And I feel that the people, I would say the organizations that are going to take the most heat, of course, are the big opera houses, the big concert halls, and the big venues, really big festivals. And I feel that it's much easier for a person like me, if I do a solo recital in a hall, which is 300 to 500 people, and there's a social distancing, you know, so even if we have, I don't know, half, if we have not 500, but 250 or 300, it's still okay for us to perform. Or if I perform chamber music, or if I perform even a concerto with a chamber orchestra, you know, it's kind of easier to do, to spread it, even though, again, I'm not sure how in practicality, the ticket sales, it's all, of course, going to suffer. And I have to say, Europe has been very lucky, especially countries like Germany, because the government is very, very instrumental and helpful towards culture. Here in the United States, as you can imagine, it's all very different. Nobody really, you know, helps you as a musician. And but again, I have to say that I was fortunate enough that most of my engagements were postponed and not canceled. So I have to be, you know, I'm very, very grateful. I did have a couple of festivals in Italy, which were, we were still discussing them. So I'm hoping we'll be able to do them in 21. But of course, this, you know, this year, we live in the whole, as Shakespeare said, this whole new world. It's new to me, right? Something like that.
Very true. And I'm, we're going to touch on one final thing before we finish, but there's also, it's a whole new world, not just for musicians, but also for music publishers as well. And you mentioned that your father works in music publishing, and I can't even begin to imagine how they're doing various different things at the moment. But I know that he's doing something very unique with his publishing company.
He actually is, and it's interesting, as if he knew that pandemic would happen, but of course he didn't. In mid-April, they had a big digital release of the platform, of a learning musical platform. And it's amazing. It's really amazing. There is a whole, there is one sort of one platform for ear training and solfege and harmony for kids. Then there is, you know, music literature courses, because, you know, in Russia, we have a lot of music schools which have a program. And I feel it's wonderful. For example, if you're a clarinet player from a third grade, you have to do certain things on your instrument. You have to do certain things on the music literature level and on your ear training and solfege and harmony. So it's all interactive, and it's all, it's been amazing. And I have to tell you, the first day when they released it, and they released it complimentary for now, because, you know, people really need to, kids need to learn. They had a 30,000 hits the first day, which is a lot. And I'm very, very proud of my father, because he's always been pushing for the digital market. And I can tell you that here in the United States, it's not even that advanced. We don't have a program like that. But I can tell you that I'm very proud that my father and sort of a Russian musical digital market, it's on such a cutting edge now. And I hope they'll be able to translate it to English one day, so we can all use it, you know, in Britain and here. But I have to say, it's been an amazing thing. And I know that the parents and the children and the teachers, they were all very happy, because it couldn't happen at a better time.
Definitely. It's always amazing when these sort of elements of synchronicity happen. And although it's a bad situation, actually having things that just happen to be in the right place at the right time to help facilitate people going forward is always incredible. And as you say, it's helping to connect to young people and musicians and families and all sorts of people, which is truly incredible. One thing that I'm always reassured about during this time is that all the science says that, and all the analytics, that classical music is one of the fastest growing genres on streaming music, and it is something that is continually resonating with people. So we actually have a potentially really strong future ahead of us online, which I think is a nice relief going forwards.
Absolutely. I think we should all be cautiously optimistic, I would say. But I know we will prevail, and, you know, it will all somewhat come back to normal. But of course, right now, it's a tough time right now, and we just have to make the best of it, I guess, right?
Yeah, very much so. And it's like you, at the beginning of your career, deciding to be your own agent. It's being creative and trying to find new ways of doing things. So before we finish, there's two questions I'm going to go into. One, which is things that you've seen online that you've really enjoyed and found rewarding, which we'll come to at the very end. But when this is all over and it comes back to promoting yourself as musicians and various bits, what are the skills or tips that you think that are really useful for promoting yourself as your own agent that people listening might be able to take forwards?
I will start with the second question first, if you don't mind. I say that, As I mentioned, and I really didn't even know how important a digital presence is for a lot of young people right now. It's much easier because, you know, when I started, not, as I mentioned, not every recital or every concert was an orchestra, was videotaped and or was recorded. So I would strongly encourage young people to do that, because even if you extract a movement or something out of a whole performance, it's still worth doing that. And now with new gadgets and iPhones, it's pretty easy. You know, you don't have to have a huge camera. And also, I would suggest, it is very hard to promote yourself, but unfortunately, we need to do that in this day and age. And if I could give one piece of advice to, you know, a young me, really, is the repertoire. Because what happens is whatever we learn, I would say, at the young age or up to 25 or 30, it really stays with us for the rest of our lives. Whatever I learned at the age of 8, you can wake me up at night, I'll come and play. As you grow a little bit older, it is harder to memorize new things. It's harder to live with new things. So I would say, you know, what I had to do in my 20s and 30s, and I had to learn a lot of new things. And I wish I did it more, you know, it was a very classical musical education. It was a bit rigid, I would even say. I would prefer that my teachers went not as thoroughly at this point, but through a lot of music repertoire. So then years later, I would take it. It would be, even if it's half ready, but it would be sort of in the back of my mind, right? As poems that you learn as a young person. That's second question. And the first question was about,
What have you seen online in the classical music world that's really made you smile during this period?
I really liked that Berlin Philharmonic was Petrenko. I really loved that performance because it was so symbolic, and it was the May. You know, May is a very special month for all of us. It's the end of World War II. Whether you celebrate May 8 or May 9th, it doesn't matter. It was the end of that, you know, horrible, horrible tragedy that happened in 20th century. And I also enjoy subscribing to my friend's channel, seeing some videos, seeing some concerts I have not seen, some plays that I wasn't able to see or I wouldn't be able to see. I do have to say that my last pre-pandemic experience after my concert was a wonderful British play that came to US luckily some time ago, Lehman Trilogy on Broadway. And it was a live experience. The hall was half empty, so there was sort of a social distance. But I have to say it was very symbolic because it has to do with the crash of 29 of stock market. And it was a very eerie feeling because in the middle of that play, when we had an intermission, that's where American borders closed.
Oh, really?
So it was a very surreal, in fact, it was a live experience. It wasn't something I saw online. But first of all, it's a phenomenal play. So if people can find it online, I think maybe British Theatre Company released it. Please do go and see it. But it was such an eerie feeling how the time arches and relates to you, that sort of one crash brings you into another crash. And people were very, you know, you could see that the mood from the first part to the second part of the audience really shifted. And it was the last Broadway performance. They closed the next day.
Wow, it's incredible timing for you. And I think it's also a wonderful note to finish on, that all the good things are British, which I think is a perfect ending moment there.
But I have to tell you, David, that I do hope that we will, if not before, we will see each other in 21 in Malta. I'm really looking forward. You know, they're planning, again, hopefully, a really big festival and a big competition for young people. And it's always wonderful to go to Malta, as you and I know. But it's going to be very special because they also skipped this festival, of course.
Yes, and so the Malta Festival, I think, starts of May is when they usually go. So it was very close for them when they obviously were cancelling things. For people who've been listening and watching, where can they find you online for all of your content and videos and music and repertoire, etc.?
My YouTube channel is just under Julia Zilberquid. I don't know if maybe you can post the link here. I'm not sure how it works. That'd be wonderful. My recordings are on iTunes and Spotify, again, under my name. And let's see. And my website is www.juliazilberquid.com. So it's all very easy.
Perfect. It's fantastic, and a lot of those links are already in the comments section already, so if you're watching online, you can click on those, and if not, I'll put them in the show notes in the podcast as well. Well, thank you so much for tuning in, either if you're watching or if you're listening back. It really is hugely appreciated. If you want to listen back to any of the other interviews with people like Anne Majet or John Jacob, we've had plenty of amazing guests. The last one with Alistair Tate from Young Classical Artist Trust was really fantastic. If you go to david-taylor.org, all the links to go to Spotify, iTunes, etc. there. And yes, I really hope you can join us on Monday when I'm talking to harpist Erilyn Jones as well, which would be really fantastic. Well, Julia, thank you so, so much for being with me today. It's really appreciated.
Thank you for having me, and thank you to everybody for listening. Bye-bye.
Absolute pleasure. Have a good day. Bye-bye.